STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
All right, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokol, your host on Stand to Reason. Glad to be with you today. Looking forward to 3 hours of discussion with you. That is, I'll open with some thoughts, and I look forward to hearing from you with your thoughts. I'll give you a piece of my mind. You give me a piece of yours. How about that? We'll be talking about ethics, values, and religion. My convictions are Christian. That is, I think that Jesus of Nazareth got reality right, and the better we understand his understanding of reality, the better we understand reality. And my goal over these 3 hours is to give you something worth thinking about, because I think that Jesus and the things taught by those who Jesus trained to follow after him are all worth thinking about. They've transformed my life. And for many of you, I know they're transforming you as well, but I'm here to make a defense for that. If you're not a follower of Christ, and if you are, to help you be a better one and to better be a fine ambassador for Christ as well. My number is 855-243-9975. If you're calling, if you're listening on podcast, just make sure you call. During our live show, which is on Tuesdays from 4 until 7. See, I have to pause because for so many years it was on a different time. I've got to get this one right. Tuesday evenings, 4 to 7, Los Angeles time. And of course, we're always happy to have you call and raise your issue, challenge, offer a question. Like I said, give me a piece of your mind. We're starting out here now, first broadcast of September. This means back to school. And I was asked recently what suggestions I have for people, Christians, who are returning to school or maybe starting their university life or college life for the first time. And I had to think about that for a while because I imagine the first thing that would come to your mind that you think would come to my mind would be some kind of issue of apologetics, like how do you deal with the relativism, or how do you deal with the atheistic charge that there is no God, or the resurrection, or you know, who knows? There's a whole host of things that are getting batted around out there, and as well as social issues that are leveraged against Christians. And social issues like abortion or same-sex marriage or homosexuality or premarital sex or just you know the list. So as I thought about this, I thought, well, then what topics, I mean, which individual things would be the most pressing? And as I thought of this, I realized that the most pressing and most important thing that I could tell a student who is going away to college would not be anything that has to do with apologetics proper. It would have to do with something else. Because college and university, secular life in general, this is true. What I'm going to say is going to be true for you regardless of whether you're in college or not, actually. But it does apply to those who are leaving their home, their environment, their community of Christian friends, those who have been there to support and encourage them and kind of keep them honest and hold their feet to the fire for a long time, and now they're venturing into a new world. And that can be really challenging. And in fact, the challenges to Christians as they leave home are often more moral than they are theological or apologetics. That is apologetical. That is, Christians falter badly, principally not because they didn't have the Kalam cosmological argument memorized. But because their character failed them when temptation overcame them. Now, coming up 3 weeks from now, I will have my 40th birthday as a Christian. In fact, my brother who led me to the Lord last night, flew in from Seattle, and on my way back met my wife, who actually met me at the airport, a rare thing, because we live an hour away from the airport, but my brother doesn't, and so we all kind of convened there to have a birthday party for him, since his birthday is, I think, today. And so my wife picked me up, then we went to my brother's house, and we were reflecting a bit on, you know, the the early days and when he had shared the Lord with me now 40 years ago before I became a Christian in that whole summer of 73 and reminiscing. But 40 years is a long time to walk with the Lord. But I will tell you something, given 40 years of meaningful relationship with God, 40 years of learning and theology and apologetics and leading in spiritual ways, some measure, when I leave home, and I go to the airport, and I get on the airplane, and I fly somewhere else. When I walk into the airport, there is an odd feeling that comes over me. And the odd feeling is something like this. I'm away. I'm on my own. People here don't know me. And possibilities begin to suggest themselves to me. There's a feeling, I don't know how else to say this, and some of you might be shocked by this, but there's a little feeling of wildness that comes into my blood when I think that I am coming into the circumstance where I have less accountability. I can do things now, being out and away, that no one will know about. Except God, of course, or except for that person who might recognize me or whatever. Now, nothing comes of this, thank God. But I want to tell you that just being a mature Christian doesn't protect me from having those kinds of challenges. If you're 16, 17, 18 years old, I guess it's more like 18, 19, 20 if you're leaving home from college. I think I was 17. So, no, I just turned 18 when I graduated from high school. You don't have 40 years of walking with the Lord. Maybe you're raised Christian, and that helps, but it's always going to be a challenge when you walk out of that environment, and it's just you, yes, and the Lord, but lots of times it feels like it's just you. Nobody's looking. And when it's just you in a community that is largely committed to profligacy and wild living, and let's face it, that's the way the university scene is, people aren't going to be telling you that you should obey your parents and do what your pastor says and follow the Bible. They are largely going to be telling you just the opposite and modeling it regularly for you. So how do you protect yourself in that situation? That is my concern. I remember my brother talking to his daughter when she's a young adult and talking about boundaries and the like for dating and this and that. You get my drift here. And he was challenged, "Dad, you don't trust me." And he said something I'll never forget. He said, "Honey, I don't trust myself." And that's kind of the way I feel. I don't trust myself. And if I don't trust myself, I'm not going to trust you on your own. In a certain sense, what I'm saying is the challenges are there. So how are you going to weather that kind of challenge? That's the issue. The moral challenge, the challenge of independence, the challenge of not having someone look over your shoulder, the challenge of being functionally able to do as you wish. How will you rise to the occasion when this kind of freedom confronts you and everyone else is doing it and goading you on and giving you opportunity, then what? So I have two recommendations for that. Here's the first recommendation. The first recommendation is that you replace the group you left with a new group. That is, you find in your community, your new community, a Christian community. And I don't mean just find a youth group or a bunch of Christians that you can hang out with and have pizza and stuff like that, that say they're believers and they're party and hardy. I'm talking about people who have kindred spirit, people who love Jesus. You know, bad company corrupts good morals. And the reverse is true. Good company strengthens good morals. I presume you do have good morals and you have good character. I want it to stay that way. You probably want it to stay that way. Find some people like you. Kindred spirit, like-minded, committed to Christ, serious about being disciples. That's the kind of people you want to hang out with. Now, there are campus groups like this. There are church groups around campus that are like this. Not every group. You're going to find some church groups and maybe even campus groups that are just not going to make the grade. Spiritually, not the kind of grade I just described. So keep your eye open and be diligent to find that family and then plug yourself in. I survived well as a growing Christian, especially when I was a new Christian, because I could not fall far. There were solid people standing all around me. It's like when you're in a really, really crowded room, you're in a packed room, you can't fall over. You land on somebody else who kind of holds you up. In fact, they tell me if you're in a crowded venue and somebody yells fire and there's a stampede, the way to keep from being trampled is just pick your feet up. Both of them. You're squeezed between all of these people, they'll just carry you along. And you won't stumble. Well, that's what I'm talking about. You want to be so hemmed about by lovely, delightful, committed disciples of Christ that you can't fall far. And these have to be people that have some visibility of your life and know of your commitment, and they're committed to you to help you survive the next 4 years or whatever as a follower of Christ. So that's the first thing. You got to get serious with a group of people who are serious. If you don't do that, I'm just telling you, look out. You could very likely be a casualty. And I don't necessarily mean that you will abandon your own convictions about Christ, but you could easily fall into debilitating sin, sin that changes your life forever, sin that can harm you and mar you and scar you. And you may come out at the other end smelling of smoke, surviving barely, but you don't want to have to go through that because I don't want for you, and I don't think you want for you just to survive college. I want for you to be an agent of change, an influencer, not just a survivor, someone who will be a light and make a difference. So that's the first thing. Here's the second thing. You have got to attend aggressively to your personal friendship with God. And in doing that, there are two things you cannot be without, and that is prayer and the Word. You are to long for the pure milk of the Word in order that by it you may grow with respects to salvation. You are to study to show yourself approved, a workman who needs not to be ashamed, handling accurately the word of truth. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to take a Bible class along with the other things. It doesn't mean that you have to have all these tomes that you're pouring through. I want to discourage you, though, from just sitting down and zipping through a chapter in the Bible and saying, okay, now I've got that done. I'm encouraging you rather to read something attentively with the mind of being changed or nurtured or encouraged or built up by what you read. So you are reading slowly, paying attention. You're not just zipping through. You are drawing nourishment from Scripture and hopefully following the rule, never read a Bible verse. So you're going to be reading paragraphs at least, not just one verse, because if you read one verse, you might get the meaning wrong. Now, it might be when you read a couple of paragraphs and you're focusing in on that and you follow the flow of thought that there's going to be a verse that hits you with its significance and meaning in the context, and that might be the one you take home with you. But my point is you want to be reading thoughtfully, reflectively, and with a mind to take home nourishment. And when it comes to your prayer, that you are genuinely and personally, maybe intimately, if you're up to that, and I'm not always up to these deep, intimate things, but genuinely, authentically talking with God. You are coming to Him with your thoughts, with your anguishes, with your desires, with your requests. You are bringing needs before Him, and you don't have to pray in a flowery way, or you don't have to pray on and on and on. The temptation that I have sometimes is when I have a simple request, I pray it the simple and straightforward way that I know, and then I think, well, I didn't say enough about that, so I'll just say it again, just in another way, and I do that five or six different ways. Well, I don't know that God's impressed with that. If you have more to say about it, then say more about it. Fine, talk from your heart to God. But don't feel obliged to fill the air with noise or spiritual psychobabble. Talk to God as if He's an actual individual. And if somebody in the room were listening to you and thought you sounded silly because of the way you're talking, or that you're babbling or something like that, well, then you should probably stop and start over. I think you get the point. I want you to survive, and not just survive, but make a difference. If you're leaving home for a professional enterprise or for school, you are leaving a much safer environment and you're going into a challenging environment. You are now on your own. And being on your own has its own challenges and temptations. It's not as easy as you think. To live on your own and be accountable to yourself before God without faltering. So my recommendations, find a group of people you can attach yourself to that have a kindred spirit and will hold you accountable and love Christ and want to be faithful to Him and make a difference. And on a regular basis, daily is the ideal. On a regular basis, nourish yourself from God's Word and nourish your friendship with God through talking with Him in a straightforward, intimate, and authentic way. And I think if you make that a life's habit, then things will go a lot better for you. I'm Greg Kokel, the number 855-243-9975 for our live show on Tuesday afternoons from 7, make that 4, until 7, Los Angeles time. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges waiting for our students are immense. Are the students you know prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are not prepared for the secular campus culture. It's time to step up the training our Christian students need to stand firm in their faith, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for one of our Rethink Student Apologetics conferences. In October, we're hosting two student conferences, one in Birmingham, Alabama, and the other in Orange County, California. These two-day conferences are designed to equip your students with the reasons for the hope they have in Jesus and the practical tools they'll need to answer the challenges they will certainly get. Plan to bring your child and encourage your church to send the youth group. Register today and find out more at rethinkapologetics.com.
Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason. 40 years in the Lord almost, and still have to work at nurturing myself in the Lord. David said, I will encourage myself in the Lord, and sometimes we have to do that. We have to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps in Christ. And if you're in a regular habit of reading the Word and in genuine prayer, authentic prayer, it'll be easier to do that. By the way, coming up here just a few weeks, let's call that 5 weeks and 7 weeks, Rethink Apologetics, a conference for middle school through college-age students. We've done this last year, great success, and we're doing it now this year in two different locations. We're reprising the event in Orange County, and I think Alan Schliemann and Brett Kunkel and myself, J. Warner Wallace, I think the whole Stand to Reason crew will be part of that and more. I don't have the breakdown right in front of me, but Orange County, October 25th and 26th. So if you are a young adult, and that's just the way I'm going to call you from now on, because if you're middle school through college age, you are a young adult and adult, and you need help. Not just what I recommended a few moments ago about being strong in the Lord and being part of a group and prayer and Bible and the like, but also you need help too in training in apologetics, that is defending your point of view and making a case for Christ. And so that's what Rethink Apologetics is all about. So October 25th and 26th will be in Orange County. And then in October 11th and 12th. See, now I got these mixed up. The 11th and 12th comes first, so that's in basically 5 weeks from now. Birmingham, Alabama. So the Birmingham event comes first, and then the Orange County event. You want more information, check out str.org, and there in the kind of rotating banner, you'll see something about Rethink Apologetics, and all the information for you will be there. Hope to see you at both of those events coming up. All right, let's go to callers, and I have Simon in Minnesota here. Simon, hey.
Hey, Craig. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
All right, well, I wanted your take on Matthew 16.
All right.
Because I understand Catholics use this to point to Peter as the first pope.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard evangelicals respond by stating that the word rock is patria in the Greek, which mm-hmm. is feminine, so mm-hmm. it can't be talking about Peter. Mm-hmm. And I've heard a lot of theologians say that the rock in Matthew 16 is referring to Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand how that could be the case, because if the word patria cannot apply to Peter because it's feminine, I figure that's
how does it apply to
Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus. Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, finally, what if it is talking about Peter? Would that point to him as the first pope? You know, so mm-hmm. I would love your take on this, because
yeah.
I read in Francis Beckwith's book, Return to Rome, that you're an ex-Catholic. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah,
I didn't know I was mentioned there in his book, but I was raised Roman Catholic. That's correct. And then in the mid-60s, when I grew up, I just kind of drifted away like a lot of people did, and then came to Christ through, I think, a much more robust characterization of the gospel through my brother and during the Jesus movement. I'm not going to generalize for all Roman Catholics, but I'll tell you, in my case, I got the bad news, but I had no good news. The good news was not good news, because the good news that I had was that you can work your way to heaven. It was based on my merit and how well I kept the laws, and if I didn't do so well, I can always go to confession and that kind of thing. So it was a merit-based salvation. When I learned about free grace, it was transforming to me. I could understand what the Christians were so excited about when they received the gospel. And it's not exciting to work, that I can work my way to heaven, and the best I could expect is a long time in purgatory, paying for my own sins and having that cleansed off before I'd even get to heaven. So, yes, I was raised Catholic. That's right, Roman Catholic. Now, when I go to this passage, I don't do the whole thing with the Greek, and I don't think it's necessary to do that.
Okay.
I'm going to approach it from a little different perspective. Here's the first question that I ask, just a broad and general one. As one surveys the Gospels, the teaching of Jesus, etc., and then the kinds of movements of the Gospel as it went forward in expression of the early church's missionary efforts, all right?
Okay.
Here's the question. Do you think that Jesus came to start an organization? You don't have to answer it. I mean, the question I bring to the table. Do you think that Jesus came to start an organization? Now, I do not get the slightest indication from anything that Jesus said, nor from any behavior of the early church, that what was in view here is trying to start a centralized organization where one person was in charge of things and kind of the power flowed down from there. That is, there will always be a voice for Christ on the earth. There would always be somebody who sat in the seat of Christ, and that's allegedly what the Pope does. And so, So I'm looking here in these passages. Now, we'll talk about Matthew 16 in a moment, but where does one get the sense that this is the kind of thing going on? And it doesn't seem like this at all. Paul goes out and starts churches. Then he leaves. And sometimes appoints elders, or maybe since Timothy or Titus to appoint elders, but, you know, then he's establishing local leadership in those local churches, and they're not kind of under a bishop who's under a pope. And indeed, when we look at the flow of Scripture, the emphasis shifts dramatically in the book of Acts from Peter, who is prominent in the first 10 chapters, to Paul, who is the player for the rest of the book. Peter disappears. So if God is going to start an organization of which Peter is the principal and the head, and from him follows a succession of those who represent Christ, why is this not evident anywhere in the text? That's my question. If this is so critical and so important. Now, I know part of the answer is, well, it is evident in the text, and that's Matthew 16. So let's go back to Matthew 16. Let's see, and start in verse 13. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, now this is in the northeast. This is at the headwaters of the Jordan River. I've been there, actually. He began asking his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? Curious phraseology, because Son of Man is a divine title. And they said, well, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, still others Jeremiah, one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? And it's a very important question. And Simon Peter answered and said, you are the Christ. You're the Messiah. You're the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said to him, and here's this relevant passage, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. Okay, good. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it, referring to the church. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Now, the key here, I think, is the phrase, the verse that you cited, that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. And then the question is, what is the rock? Now, it strikes me that there are a number of possibilities that are legitimate. This rock could be referring to Peter himself, regardless of the tense of the nouns in this case. Okay, I'm not going to fuss about that. Okay, upon this rock, it could be referring to Peter. It could be I think that is a fair interpretation. Okay, that is a reasonable interpretation. I do not think it's the only reasonable interpretation.
Okay,
it also could be referring to the rock could be Jesus. Jesus, that is the one Peter just testified to. Or it could be the testimony of Jesus that is the Christ, the Son of God. And that is the foundational testimony that is the rock upon which the church is built, that one will that the gates of hell will not prevail against. So it strikes me that there are at least three possibilities that are legitimate and that are arguable, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But this takes me to back to my original question. If the Roman claim amounts to that Jesus had intended to build an organization with a long-term expectation of a certain hierarchy and all of these particulars that encompass Roman Catholicism. And central to that is Peter as you put it, the first pope. Then where is the reference for that? And the reference for that is here, and the only single one individual reference for that kind of thing is equivocal.
Mm-hmm.
So my larger question is, did God come to start an organization? All right. Now, if we go back to Peter, to Matthew 16, as the Roman Church's validation that he did and put Peter first, and this then justifies the sequence of succession of popes with the authority that Peter had. I'm going to ask the question, how do you get that out of this passage? Because first, there are three possibilities here, and all of them seem good. Here's the killer for me. Even if the rock is Peter, how do you get Peter the first pope with the role that the Roman Catholic Church gives to the pope and all the succession of popes that follow? Where do you get the whole structure, the whole organization justified, even if Jesus is referring to Peter, who is the rock upon which he builds his church? Let's just say that's what Jesus means.
Okay.
Peter then is the chief disciple. He's part of the inner circle, Peter, James, and John, and he takes the lead. He's the one who is supposed to, after he denies Christ, Jesus had prayed for, and he is to strengthen the flock, the sheep. Feed my sheep. You know, Jesus said, I prayed for you, and you will endure, or something like that at the Last Supper. And then we see the encounter there by the Sea of Galilee in a post-resurrection appearance where Jesus says, feed my flock three times, you know, kind of patterned after the threefold denial of Peter. Okay, so then Peter he's the head of the apostolic band. That doesn't mean he's the head of the whole church. He's the head of everybody and everything, and there always has to be one of those guys. So when Peter dies, he gives that same authority to someone else. Where is papal succession in this? See, I think this is a very, very top-heavy system that is looking and straining for a verse to justify the system, and this is what they come up with. And part of my common sense approach is, Simon, if Jesus really intended to build an entire organization, I think he would have left behind a lot more detail about his intention than what you find equivocally in Matthew 16. And those in Peter himself would have communicated more detail than what he did in his writings, and so would have Paul, etc., because I'm sure they all would have been aware that what God wanted was to build an organization, so let's get on with it. But none of them are on with building an organization, none of them.
Right.
I mean, you can judge for yourself based on what you know in the book of Acts and everything, but I will make this observation that Peter himself in 1 Peter, and let me see if I can quickly get to the reference. It'd be hard. I keep forgetting my Bible, my functional one, my big one with all my notes in it, the one where I put my marginal references. And what I have left here is the one I bought in Thailand 30 years ago, and it's all fallen apart. So this is one that's in the office. So I don't know if I'm going to get the 1 Peter passage. Oh, in 1 John, I went too far. Peter talks about, well, you know, it's in 1 Peter, and I think it's in chapter 1. And when Peter talks about Jesus, he refers to Jesus as the rock. Where is that? He refers to Jesus as the rock. And he's talking about Moses and the spiritual rock or whatever, you know, and whatever. But he says Jesus is the rock. I'll find it, and I'll mention it later on in the broadcast, but after the break, okay. After the break, I'll look for it. But so when Peter is asked who the rock is, now he's not being asked with regards to this specific passage, but it does strike me as interesting that this notion of Peter being the rock and the foundation and the Pope, you don't see this further on. Actually, Paul is the one who takes over the main focus. Paul is the one who rebukes Peter in Galatia for his hypocrisy. Paul's the authority there, not Peter. And actually, when Paul talks about, I never thought of this. Oh, when Paul talks in Galatians about checking out his gospel with the so-called pillars, he's a little bit, I got to find that now. He's got a little bit of submissive voice regarding them. Well, not that they are nobodies, but it isn't like they're the pillars, the so-called pillars or whatever, you know. He didn't say that I went to the Pope, checked it out with Peter to make sure that I wasn't running in vain. He did check it out with the elders, Peter, James, and John. But the tone of that is not that Peter's the main guy, and then later on we realize that Peter's going to follow the truth and Paul's got to correct him. Then when Peter refers to the rock, he's referring to Jesus in his own writings. And also in Jerusalem Council, it wasn't Peter that was heading up the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 10. I think it was James. So Peter just seems to fade from the biblical record. What happened to the first pope? And even if he was the guy in charge, it looks like he fades, so he didn't have this central role the way that is characterized him on through the life of the early church. And I don't know, even if Peter is the first pope, where do you get papal succession? Where do you get that out of Matthew 16? So I think, you know, yeah, one foot on the pier and one foot on the boat, you know, and this is a very unstable position, I think, even though I haven't resolved the question of who the rock is. That's why I don't fuss about the Greek, because I don't think that's necessary. I think there are other considerations that allow us to dismiss this option.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate it.
Does that make sense to you at least?
It does, yes.
Okay. Awesome. During the break, which I'm coming up to, and I thank you, Simon, for your call. During the break, I'll look those passages up and see if I can find that information. All right, Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Paul encourages us to be ready with an answer when someone asks for the reason for the hope we have in Jesus. We can help you be ready with those answers. Stand to Reason's website has thousands of pages of free and helpful resources on current issues and questions. At str.org, you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the many issues that challenge Christian thinkers in today's world. Topics like why Jesus is the only way, are science and faith compatible, same-sex marriage, and many others. Take a few moments to explore str.org. You can sort through the content by topic, author, and resource type. All of STR's speakers have articles, podcasts, and videos that provide practical answers to challenging questions. Visit the blog daily, read the latest Solid Ground, interact with the weekly challenge, listen to the weekly webcast. I'm convinced you'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. Try it today. That's str.org.
All right, Greg Kochel here, and I'm scanning my New Testament. I'm in 1 Peter chapter 2 because trying to find the verse that I promised. Here we go. Chapter 2 and verse 4. Now, remember, this is on the question of who is the rock in Matthew 16, and I'm willing to concede it's possible that it's Peter, but even if it is Peter, that doesn't give you Peter the Pope in the sense that Rome declares. But I do think it's interesting when Peter writes about Jesus, it says, in coming to him, make that 1 Peter 2:4, in coming to him, Jesus, as a living stone, rejected by men, but choice and precious in the sight of God, you also as living stones are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood. So you come to Jesus as a living stone, and then you are built on top of him. But those who are displayed a stone of stumbling, a rock of offense there, and I'm just cruising down. I know there's another verse that I thought, and it says, but the rock is Christ. I can't find that one. So here it says Jesus is a stone, but it says we're living stones, so that's not decisive. But I do think it's interesting that Peter, in this other passage, which I can't find right now, says the rock is Christ. I did find the Galatians passage. Now, I have never thought on this before regarding this issue, Paul's comments in Galatians. Now, as you recall, Paul, Saul of Tarsus, was called literally by God, by Jesus, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Okay, so there is this dramatic intervention. He becomes a believer and begins preaching the gospel such as he understands it. But in the book of Galatians, since he is dealing with a profound theological problem in the Galatian region where he planted churches, he gives a bit of a testimony post-conversion. And he says there that, and this is regarding the testimony, the gospel of grace that he's communicating. He says, for I would have you know, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man. For I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it. But I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. I bet a lot of you didn't know this. That the bulk of Paul's early training with regards to the details of the gospel, he got directly by revelation from Jesus. For you have heard of my former manner of life in Judaism, how I used to persecute the church of God, etc. And he goes on, and then how that God was pleased to reveal a son in him that he might preach his name among the Gentiles. And when he did, verse 16, I did not immediately consult with flesh and blood. What does he mean by flesh and blood? He means other human beings. And who would that be? That would be the main guys, the main Christians that are preaching. He said, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, Incidentally, he does not single out any one there as the main dude. He sees the apostolic group as a group who had authority. But when he has his message, since he received it as revelation, he did not go up to the apostles, not at first, but went away to Arabia and then returned once more to Damascus. Then 3 years later, I went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas, that's Peter. And I stayed with him for 15 days. Now, he did go see Peter. He says, I did not see any other apostles except James, the Lord's brother. And then I went to Syria and Cilicia, and I was still unknown by sight to the churches of Judea, which were in Christ, but they only kept hearing about his salvation. And then chapter 2, verse 1. Then after an interval of 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along also. And it was because of a revelation that I went up. And I submitted to them those in Jerusalem, which would certainly include Cephas and James and others, Peter and James. I submitted to them the gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but I did so, I met with them, in private, so that those who were of reputation, for fear that I might be running or had run in vain. So he brought this to them privately, and thinking, maybe I'm making a mistake here. And then he continues, but not even Titus, who was with me, though he was Greek, was compelled to be circumcised. So the Jewish, a Gentile believer, even with the principles of the faith there in Jerusalem, was not required to live like a Jew, essentially. But in verse 6, and this is where I'm cashing this out, but from those who were of high reputation, now speaking still of the apostles in Jerusalem, what they were makes no difference to me, parenthetically, God shows no partiality. Well, those who were of reputation contributed nothing to me, but on the contrary, seeing that I had been entrusted with the gospel to the uncircumcised, as Peter had been to the circumcised, and they recognized the grace that God had given me and sent me on my way, basically. It's interesting how he refers to those guys. He does go up to them. He wants their counsel. But what he says, that these of high reputation, I think I'm reading this correctly. You can go back and read it for yourself, chapter 2, verse 6. Those of high reputation, but what they were makes no difference to me. For God shows no partiality, he says parenthetically. Wow, I thought this was Peter the Pope. Why isn't he going with his hat in his hand saying, you're the guy. You're the guy upon whom Jesus said Christ would build his church. But he doesn't say that. He says God shows no partiality. These guys are, yeah, they have good reputation, but you know, that doesn't matter to me. We're all equal here as leaders in the church is the way I read it. And then just a little later, he talks about calling Peter on the carpet for being hypocritical, calling him on the carpet in front of others. So I don't know, this doesn't seem to fit so smoothly with the idea that Peter was in fact the first pope. But it didn't seem that Paul was seeing it that way. It's something to think about. All right, let's see. Buffalo, New York, take a call here. Nick, hi.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. So thanks for taking my call, first
mm-hmm.
of all.
Mm-hmm. Welcome.
About a year and a half ago, someone I'm close to challenged me with this question, and I didn't know how to respond. I was reading through Genesis this past week and was reminded of this challenge. I still couldn't seem to come up with a full explanation mm-hmm. for it. Challenge was towards God in the Old Testament, just generally speaking, but specifically toward Noah and the flood. The challenge was something that this person felt that God seemed to be like a quote-unquote mean kid with a magnifying glass on an anthill, as he put it. Mm-hmm. And I think what he was trying to get at was that if God's supposed to be all-knowing, all-loving, eternal, et cetera, why would he make humans, knowing beforehand that we weren't going to get it right, flood the entire earth, killing everything except whom what was on the ark, and feel the need to start over, mm-hmm. even though after he started over, people still wouldn't be much better off.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like, you know, if that's the situation that he needed to start with for humans on Earth, and why didn't he just start there?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I kind of figured there's an element of free will involved with this answer, and then also partially that because God had created humans, he had the power to do away with them if he so chooses.
Well, yeah, he certainly was justified in doing that, but I don't think that's at the heart of the question. I think the heart of the question is simply, if God knew it would go so bad, why did he go through with it to begin with? Because
right, yeah.
Everybody save eight in the ark were destroyed. So this is I have a couple of thoughts on this, but I want to preface my thoughts by saying you always want to be careful of expecting that the right answer is going to be satisfying to a person who is belligerent to the truth, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that may – somebody who doesn't agree with me on these spiritual things might think that I'm poisoning the well here or stacking the deck in my favor or something like that. Oh, yeah, that his problem is he just can't bear the truth. But I'm just setting you up in advance that some of the answers to these things are not going to be satisfying to people.
Right.
I don't expect non-believers to feel comfortable with this. Notice how the way you started something about, well, God's not very loving or whatever, and then he's like a little kid who's mean, burning up ants with a magnifying glass. Well, there's no picture like that of God in the Old Testament. What he's done is graciously made free will creatures to be in relationship with him, and they've rebelled against him, and he punished them. And so I don't know why punishing evil people should be construed as like a kid enjoying burning ants with a magnifying glass. I don't think that God doesn't take pleasure in this. It isn't fun for him. So I just think that's an unfair characterization of the biblical record. If a person wants to go after the biblical account, then he's welcome to do so. But he's got to go after the biblical account and not some caricature of it. Secondly, you made the way one thing you said, and wouldn't God have been better off if he would have just started with Noah and not had all those other people? Now, this raises another issue, this question of what would have been better. And I don't know that we're in a position to know that. I know lots of times people will say, look at a set of circumstances and say, well, why would God have done this? And incidentally, those kinds of questions fall into a category of questions that almost never can be answered this side of heaven, because God hasn't told us why. And just because we don't know the answer why doesn't mean he didn't have a good reason. And some people will go that direction. Well, I can't figure out why, so it must have been a bad move on God's part. And I think that's an unfair approach to these kinds of questions. It could be that God knows a whole lot more. And so the claim that no more than we do. So the claim that wouldn't they be better off if presumes that we know better about this than God did, and if it were us in the driver's seat, we would have done it better. And I don't know that we know enough to be able to say that. Yes, lots of people were lost in the flood and lots lost afterwards, but many are being saved now. And who is in a good position, who's in a better position to know whether it was worth it or not? I don't think we're in a good position to know that, because we just are not omniscient. And I could tell the story. I don't have time now, but the Battle of Midway in the Second World War, the Pacific Theater, which turned the tide of the war, at least in the sea battle, and how it seemed like a complete and utter loss until there was a turn that in 5 minutes destroyed the Japanese fleet. In 5 minutes, everything turned around. And it turns out that all of those losses that happened early on were necessary for that 5-minute victory. It all tied in amazingly. So, are we in a position to know? No, we're some of these. We're like these torpedo bombers that are getting strafed and struck down left and right by the Japanese gunships there, and the anti-aircraft fire. And we think it's all a waste, but in the big picture, it may look very different. And so I'm just holding out for that possibility. I mentioned also, and I just got like 60 seconds to go, so let me give you a quick summary here. And this is the part that probably your friend is not going to like. When God allows man to rebel, he can do one of two things. He can provide forgiveness or he can punish. When he provides forgiveness, he exercises his mercy, and that is a good thing. And so when he forgives, he glorifies himself. He brings honor to an honorable being. Yet those he does not give mercy to, he punishes. Well, then he's punishing guilty people. And when he punishes guilty people, that's also a good thing. And he also brings honor to himself when he does that. And so in both cases, one could argue whether God knew these evil people were coming. And when they came, either when he punished them or when he forgave them, whatever the case may be, he is still doing something good. And as to whether it was all worth it or not, I think God is the only one in the position to know that. We can speculate at our end, but we're kind of looking through the wrong end of the telescope here, right? We cannot see. We're like looking through a keyhole. We don't see everything that's going on. And I don't think it's unfair to appeal to that, because the fact is we just don't see. And to draw conclusions about the propriety of certain actions of God, from our perspective, based on what we do see, and to do it with impunity, it seems to me is specious. It might be better for us to say, well, doesn't make sense to me, but it could be that it does make good moral sense to God, that he had a morally sufficient reason for doing these things, and maybe we'll find out later. So there may be other arguments that are good arguments against God or against the Bible, whatever, but I don't think that one is a good one. The Old Testament has abundant references of the mercy and patience of God, and even in the case of the flood, God waited and waited and waited until all of mankind, save eight, were completely corrupted by sin, and then he lowered the boom. You can't say he didn't give men a chance, and that is the way God is, characteristically long-suffering. All right, lines open here on Stand to Reason. Look forward to talking to you, 855-243-9975, if you're calling in on Tuesday between 4 and 7. I'm Greg Kokel. Next hour, coming right up. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. Welcome to our show, friends. Our second hour here. And glad to have you all on board, whether you're in Southern California listening by tape delay on Sunday, or Texas for that matter, or anywhere in the American Family Radio Network around the country, or listening by podcast. Live on Tuesdays from 4 until 7 Los Angeles time, my call-in number 855-243-9975. And by the way, if you are outside the U.S., we have a special number for you. Occasionally get calls from different parts of the world. In fact, for one Sunday in the past, got calls from four different continents. That number is 855-243-9975. Starting out this hour, I want to go back to an old topic a topic that I have spoken on many times. It happens to be one that I just addressed at length in Seattle at a church retreat, I guess some people might be wondering, well, if he's addressed it so many times, why would he go back to this? And the reason is because there are so many people that are confused on this particular issue, and it matters. So my brother, who lives in another state, not the pastor brother, part of a church there, and the church has a lot of lay leaders, and he's one of them. He's doing, actually, the Bible Fast Forward with a group of people, and as a sanctioned group on that church, he being the leader, he needs to attend some leadership training stuff, which I think is a great idea. So there's oversight, there's accountability, and they know what's going on in their community, etc. And Dave's a really sharp guy. He's a good instincts, solid theology, great apologetics. In fact, now I think about it, I can't think of anybody who's learned more from Stand to Reason than my brother Dave. And in fact, partly because not just does he get all the materials and stuff like that, listen to the show. Hi, Dave. But we talk a lot on the phone and we knock around things. Well, recently we were chatting and he told me about one of those church leadership meetings and the training that he encountered there. Well, they had a missionary come in to teach this group, and the thrust of this training was, and this was, I think, the first of a series of sessions that the missionary who was representing the church leadership would have with this lay leadership of the church to train them in the skill of Christian living. And I do think living is a skill. Being a Christian is a skill. It's something you develop over time. It's a habit that you get into. You develop patterns that become habits, and you increase your skill as a follower of Christ. The writer of Hebrews said that over time, becoming accustomed to the word of righteousness, you have your senses trained to discern good and evil. So there is certainly a skill here, and there's a skill in understanding the word, etc. So lots of skill that needs to be developed to be an effective Christian, and if you're going to be a leader in any capacity, you need to develop those skills. And so that's what this meeting was about. And so the missionary said he wanted to start out this series of sessions of training by addressing the most important skill that needs to be learned for anyone as an effective Christian. Now, I'm just curious, what if I kind of put out a quiz on the internet or something, or just quizzed you? So let's just do it rhetorically. I quizzed you and I said, considering the fact that the Christian life is a skill, what would the most important skill? Now, I want you to think in terms of skill sets right now, all right, of the particular activities that are part of being a Christian. What would you say is the most important skill that needs to be developed? Now, I have a strong opinion about this. In fact, I wrote a piece about it, which I started out saying, and I wish I had the quote right now in front of me. Do we have one of those booklets handy? Do we have one of those booklets handy that we send in to our new people? I don't want to say the title right now. I'm asking the enforcer for that. I thought I have an idea what that means. No, it's not that one. That's okay. That's all right. I can do without it. I should have prepared properly for this, and I didn't. But basically I said, I can paraphrase, if I had one thing that I can impart to you, and that's all, as a Christian, if there's one impact I could leave behind with you, if there's one important skill that I could invest in you, what would that skill be? And that's the answer to the question here. And I'm just going to give you a hint that I don't think this is just a matter of opinion, because there is a logical priority to this skill. So now I am hinting. There's a logical priority because any skill that you might mention is important for a Christian to learn, because you're citing some passage of Scripture as support, is going to depend on another skill that, as it turns out, also is mentioned in Scripture everywhere. And what is that skill? Put simply, in the words of Paul, 2 Timothy, rightly dividing the word of truth. Rightly dividing the word. The first skill that you need to really get good at, and not that you have to get good at this before you start developing the other, but first in matter of priority and logical priority, it seems to me, is you have to learn how to read your Bibles properly. You have to be able to get God's truth from God's word. Pretty obvious, huh? But that isn't what he said. What this pastor said is the first and most important skill that you need to learn is how to be led by the Spirit. Now, I can think of lots of places where Scripture declares that we need to learn the Word. Let the Word of Christ dwell within you richly. Where's that, Ephesians? Long for the pure milk of the Word, in order that by it you may grow with respect to salvation. 1 Peter 2. Study to show yourself approved of God, a workman who does not need to be ashamed, handling accurately the word of truth. 2 Timothy 2. All Scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, that the man of God might be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. 2 Timothy 3. The word I have hidden in my heart, that I might not sin against you. That's Psalm 119 somewhere, right? And I could go on. These are the ones that I just got off the top of my head. I'm sure there's a whole bunch more. The Word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing asunder the division between soul and spirit, of both joints and marrow, and able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart. I've got all kinds of verses that drive me to the Word. Where are all the verses that say the most important thing you can learn to do is to be led by the Spirit, or anything akin to that? Now, of course, the phrase led by the Spirit is in the Bible. It's in Romans 8 and Galatians 5, only two places, and Paul uses them in both cases exactly the same way. But it's interesting what's being said there. Paul does not say that we should be learned to be led by the Spirit. It said all those who are led by the Spirit are sons of God, and Paul does not mean led by the Spirit in that passage, or the Galatians passage for that matter, the way that this missionary meant led by the Spirit, or every single Christian I've ever heard cite the concept. They have all gotten it wrong. Now, I know that sounds grotesquely bold and maybe even arrogant. I'm sorry. I'm not speaking here in an uppity manner. I'm just simply saying that when Christians talk about being led by the Spirit and think they're referring to what Paul means in Romans 8, it's clear to me they've never read Romans 8, because Paul means nothing of the kind. if you follow the line of thought in Romans 8, and I can't go line by line with you on this one, but if you follow the line of thought, what Paul means in Romans 8 is that those who have the Spirit are in the Spirit, and those in the Spirit are putting to death the deeds of the flesh by the Spirit, and that's called being led by the Spirit. And then when you go to Galatians 5, you see the same thing. If you walk in the Spirit, you will not fulfill the desires of the flesh. For those who are led by the Spirit are not under the law. So walk by the Spirit, led by the Spirit, in parallel, mean the same thing. It means you are not under the law because you're not fulfilling the desires of the flesh. The law doesn't even apply to you. You don't need the law for somebody who's already keeping the law. The law is made for rebellious people, not for obedient people. Paul says that in another place. So in both places that Paul talks about the leading of the Spirit, he's not talking about getting nudges in directions for decision-making. Now, am I saying that God can never do that? No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying Paul does not mean that when he talks about being led by the Spirit. And I'm also saying there is no place in the New Testament where such a thing is taught. So how is it, if the New Testament is filled with exhortations to learn the Word, know the Word, study the Word, divide it rightly, long for the Word, let it dwell within you richly, because it's inspired by God and it's profitable and it's living, and therefore we hide it in our heart. If all of these things are true about the Word, then why aren't we saying the most important thing you could do as a Christian, the skill you develop, is knowledge of the Word? Instead of telling Christian leaders it's something the Bible never even makes reference to in the way that they're putting it. Now, here's what's ironic about this. Is the professor, I should say the missionary, gave two proof texts, both from the book of Acts. The first one was Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. What is that, Acts chapter 8 or thereabouts? And the second one, it was Acts chapter 10, when Peter received a vision that eventually directed him to Cornelius the Gentile. And these were the proof texts. These were the texts that were supposed to prove or demonstrate validate the claim that the most important thing we could do is learn to be led by the Spirit. But in neither of those circumstances, whether Philip or Peter, did they learn anything. This wasn't a skill that they learned. Instead, it just happened to them. Let's just see if I can find it here. Verse 26 of Acts 8, Philip, an angel of the Lord spoke to Philip, saying, now it does not say there's no indication, there's no hint that Philip had kind of been in the school of hearing from God. Because frankly, God doesn't try. And if God wants to speak to anybody, he speaks and he gets it done. He doesn't mumble. People say God is trying to speak to you, but you're not listening. What do you mean try? God doesn't try. Here, the Holy Spirit simply spoke, and Philip heard. Don't forget, by the way, that when the Holy Spirit spoke, Jesus spoke to Saul, he was unregenerate, murdering Christians. Yet he had no problem hearing. But an angel of the Lord spoke to Philip, saying, arise and go south to the road that descends from Jerusalem to Gaza, the desert road. And he arose and went. Behold, there was an Ethiopian eunuch. Come to Jerusalem to worship, returning and sitting in his chariot, reading Isaiah. And the Spirit said to Philip, go up and join the chariot. So the Spirit speaks, go to this place. Then the Spirit says, go up and join. And then they have a conversation, and then Philip leads this person to Christ and then baptizes him, having preached Jesus to him, verse 35. And let's see, and verse 39, and then when they came up out of the water after the baptism, the Spirit of the Lord snatched Peter away, Was that something? I'm sorry, snatch Philip away. Was that something that Philip learned? Beam me up, Scotty. And the eunuch saw him no more. And Philip found himself at Azotus, up the coast. And he kept preaching the gospel to all the cities until he came to Caesarea. So, is there any indication in that passage that Philip learned to be led by the Spirit? No, I don't think so. The Spirit spoke, he heard. He obeyed, and then the Spirit grabbed him and took him elsewhere. In the case of Peter sees a vision. He's just up there praying. He's not listening. He's praying. All of a sudden, there's a vision. Kill and eat all these animals on a tarp. Happens 3 times. He's trying to figure out what it means. Isn't that interesting? If this is the proof text of learning to hear, to be led by the Spirit, Peter is mystified by the meaning. And it isn't until somebody knocks at his front door and says, by the way, we're here representing Cornelius, and Cornelius had a vision, said we should come find you, and you should come with us and talk to him. And then, of course, Peter figures out the meaning of the vision, where God says, whatever he calls clean, don't you call unclean. No, he used to call the Gentile unclean, so now the Gentile's at his door, wants to hear the gospel. Peter figures it out and goes along with him. But notice also that the Gentile Cornelius also had a vision. So are we to presume then from this text that Cornelius learned to hear the voice of God? Hardly. Do you see how specious this is? Now, here's the irony. The irony is this, I'm sure, very good man. I have no reason to doubt his goodness or his sincerity. He says something that is not sound. That is, the most important skill you can learn is to be led by the Spirit instead of learning how to use your Bibles properly. And then, to prove his point, he misuses his Bible. Apparently, he hasn't learned to use his Bible properly. So, as I said, there's a logical priority here. I'm going to, if you tell me there's any other thing that's more important as a foundational Christian skill than being able to read your Bible accurately, the only way you're going to make your point is to point to a Bible verse, and the only way you're going to be able to know that that's what it means is if you learned to read your Bible accurately. So note that logical priority there. Anyway. All right, that's good enough for now. Calls coming up here. The piece that I mentioned and I was trying to find earlier is called Never Read a Bible Verse, and that's the way I start that piece out. Maybe I'll find a copy of it and read it to you next segment, but it's linked on Twitter for you, so you can go there, because what I've tried to do is take seriously my intention of trying to equip you in the most foundational thing that I know of reading your Bibles accurately, and that's why I titled the piece the way I did, and I explained the content of Never Read a Bible Verse as you go through it. So check that out. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that'll help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that'll help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a 4-part template that'll help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the Gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the Gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the Gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to str.org to listen live or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time by going to str.org. All right, friends, I found that piece for you. It's the opening of Never Read a Bible Verse, subtitled The Most Important Thing I Could Ever Teach You. And here's the way I start that piece. If there was one bit of wisdom, one rule of thumb, one single skill I could impart, one useful tip I could leave that would serve you well the rest of your life, what would it be? What is the single most important practical skill I have ever learned as a Christian? Never read a Bible verse. That's right. Never read a Bible verse. Instead, always read a paragraph, at least if you want to unlock the meaning of a passage. So there you have it. And we have that at Stand to Reason. I think, is it going through, are we reprinting that or something? Or can people, we're in the process of reprinting that, so we don't actually have it at the moment. We used to send it out in our, it's on the website? Oh, okay. So you can purchase it. You can, oh, download it for free. All righty. Well, that's even better. At that price, I'll take two. The link, again, on Twitter. And if you're listening by delay, if you go to what will be now Wednesday the 4th, September 4th, blog, the Enforcerare's blogs, the information we talked about there, so you can find those things. So, all right, let's see. I want to talk with Greg in Leesburg, Virginia. There you go. Greg, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. Thanks.
Sure.
It's a real pleasure. I've been listening to the podcast for many years and have a busy life and just have never been able to call in.
So. Well, I'm glad you've listened and I'm glad you're calling.
Great. So if I sound like I'm reading here, I've been thinking about this question for a very long time, so I've kind of written it out a bit here, but it specifically relates to, you know, caring for the poor or social justice, right?
Okay.
So my background is in more law and economics, not mm-hmm. philosophy,
mm-hmm.
and I have a, you know, a fairly Austrian or classical liberal kind of economics viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
which frankly I had before I was a Christian,
mm-hmm.
but I've, you know, sort of back associated that with, you know, my Christian worldview to a certain degree, right?
Uh-huh. Okay. You know, I'm trying to remember what the Austrian view is. Is that free market stuff, or is that?
Yeah, exactly. So
okay,
it's
yeah.
called Austrian primarily for Friedrich Hayek, who, you know, is a sort of a free market.
Right, like a Milton Friedman.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, obviously those of us in that sort of...
Oh, incidentally, that it is interesting that it turns out that view is the classically liberal view, because liberalism now is...
I'm in the D.C. area here, and I'm just accustomed to saying that.
Yes, right.
By classical liberal, I mean what we sometimes call conservative in a sense.
Yes, right? And it's and leftism has taken over liberalism. And,
exactly. And, you know, I think classical liberal is actually the more accurate way to put it, right?
Uh-huh, so, right.
Than conservative. And likewise, rather than liberal, I like to use the word progressive, right?
Okay.
And so that's kind of where my question is going, in the sense of when we're dealing with, you know, the Sojourner Jim Wallace types, right?
Uh-huh.
Not
Jay
Warner
Waller,
Wallace,
right, but the other Jim, Wallis.
Right. They sometimes frame it in a way that makes it seem like our differences are that we don't care for the poor.
Yes, that's a convenient way of putting it, I think,
mm-hmm.
and I think it is it's disheartening to hear that, because they ought to know better.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, with regards to the facts of the matter, I have a friend who's a radio show, and his main rule is first tell the truth, then give your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular case, they're not telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So they may still disagree with our view, and our view might be wrong, but let's not misrepresent it, at least.
Yeah, exactly. And so when, you know, debating those types, you know, one of the first things I try to, you know, make clear is that as Christians, we agree fundamentally that we have an obligation to care for the poor,
mm-hmm.
right, in some sense.
Yeah.
The disagreement that we actually have is over what is the sort of most efficacious way of bringing that about, right?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I think part of it also is the nature of the we. Who mm-hmm. is the we that
exactly.
has the obligation?
Absolutely. And, uh-huh. Right. Okay. Should it be a bureaucracy or the church?
Or is it speaking to God's people, or is mm-hmm. it speaking... is it speaking to a government institution? Is it speaking to individuals?
But
before we go further, let me mm-hmm. ask you for a definition, okay? You use the phrase social justice.
Right.
How do you mean that term?
You know, I use it because they use it,
uh-huh.
right?
But they use it in a very particular way.
Yeah, exactly. And so I used it to reference the way they frame it, given that I disagree with their framing.
Okay,
it,
so
right?
in their sense, social justice really amounts to redistribution of wealth.
Right.
So that yeah, okay, got
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so you know, this brings me to you know the economics part that I'm familiar with that, right? You know, and I could make arguments about why I believe that. A sort of, again, classical liberal or liberty-oriented distribution of economics is actually better for
the poor.
Yeah, that's
Jay Richards has argued that in his
mm-hmm.
book, and I think a lot of people argue that way. Capitalism is good for the poor if
mm-hmm.
it's allowed to do what it can do.
Right.
Yeah.
And then where I get sort of confused on the theological or philosophical part and what I've really been wanting to know is does God have, obviously as an omniscient God, he surely does have an opinion or knowledge about these sort of amoral questions. Of course, you know, what the ideal economic system in a fallen world is, mm-hmm. I'm not interested in a sort of unattainable ideal.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, to what extent does God try to communicate to us, obviously through the scriptures, how we should sort of organize social life like that? Where if we agree the moral question is, let's care for the poor, the disagreement is on that sort of amoral question of how best do we do that? Does the Bible give us sort of instruction on that amoral part of the question?
Well, let me pick at something just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this will help, maybe not. But if I guess what I'd want to say is, if it's amoral, then God doesn't have an opinion on it.
Mm-hmm.
If God
well,
has
I mean,
an opinion
like,
on it, then it
would... effective, you know?
Yeah, well, and now that's a prudential kind of question. And,
mm-hmm.
and would God know what the most effective way to do that is?
Right.
From a pragmatic sense, yes, he would know that, okay? I'm just wondering, though, if there are more, and this is completely speculation,
mm-hmm.
even if there is a most pragmatic way to do it, it doesn't necessarily mean that it in the final tally of moral goods, you're going to get the most moral goods out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so God would want to be maximizing the moral element of it. So
mm-hmm.
it might be that pragmatically, you can accomplish a goal in this way. You get more widgets of whatever your widgets happen to be here. Maybe there are more people fed or something like that out of this more pragmatic approach. But it may be soul damaging in other ways. So,
mm-hmm.
so I don't know that it's going to be helpful where God hasn't given us some kind of guideline that is pretty concrete, whether it's going to be helpful to get God into the picture in this discussion. I think that we can refer to moral obligations or virtues or principles or guidelines or whatever that are seem to be pretty clearly established and then we can use those to inform the process. But when it gets down to the nitty-gritty particulars, I think it's going to be hard for us to say, yeah, this is the system, the very particular system that God
mm-hmm.
has most in mind, because I don't think God showed his hand on that, and this is where it's up to us to try to kind of take the larger things and then hash out the details. And I don't think the scripture goes into more detail on those things because God wants us to hash these out. He could have,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
he did not intend to use his revelation to accomplish that kind of granularity in moral decision making, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to take the broader principles, liberty being a huge one, One, a human obligation to the poor. Remember that the church has an obligation to the poor mm-hmm. because there is. Here's the way I would cash it out. I never quite put it this way before, but there is a human obligation to the poor, an individual obligation to the poor, to help poor people. And this is one of the things that Sodom and Gomorrah was faulted for not doing.
Right.
They mm-hmm. weren't Jews. They weren't Christians, you know. They were heathen. But even so, as heathen, they still had an obligation to the poor, which they denied. And this comes up, in Jeremiah. One of the prophets mentions it.
Ezekiel maybe, something.
Yeah, Ezekiel. I think you're right about that. And so, but because there is this general obligation, then Christians corporately have an obligation as well to the poor. The mm-hmm. question is, I think, do governments have an obligation to the poor?
Right.
Because the only way for governments to fulfill obligations to the poor is to redistribute wealth. And that creates its own problems. Now you
right,
have
and its own moral problems that we can answer, right?
Yes.
That is immoral, right?
Yeah. Well, arguably. I'm mm-hmm. not going to try to be dogmatic. I'll just let
sure,
you say,
sure, of course. But in terms of framing it on, yeah.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, if redistributing wealth and once one starts doing that, then that brings with it its own set of problems. And here I'm going back to my earlier comment about soul-destructive actions. Mm-hmm. Think of the Great Society of LBJ, back a more classic liberal, I think, I don't know if I call him totally classic liberal, but certainly the Democratic Party was more liberal and less left than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but he had this grand design. Okay, let's make the Great Society. And ADC, Aid to Dependent Children, was the cornerstone of that.
Right.
But what do we learn 40 years later is ADC destroyed the African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have some 60-70% of children in that community being born without fathers.
Right.
And that's not a good thing, for goodness sake. And crime that has shown up from that. And nothing really has been solved with regards to the broader problem of poverty and those kinds of things. Instead, what we have is new problems because that was well-intentioned but misguided. And the soul was destroyed because the government got involved in that kind of thing. And it ended up encouraging people to have women not get married.
Mm-hmm.
Because then
mm-hmm.
they'd lose their government aid, and they got a job after all, and the check's coming in on a regular basis. They don't want to get fired.
Yeah, sure. And to some extent, the state moves into the sort of paternal role, and mm-hmm. that abdicates that paternal role away from the people in that community.
Yeah, the paternals, the fathers.
Exactly.
Yeah. and I understand, well, what about that poor individual? And see, this is what happens all the time in these kinds of discussions, is an individual gets trotted forward. And the dictum that I'm sure you know well is hard cases make bad policy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so consequently, you can't just look at the individual hard case. You've got to look at the longer term impact and not just what you hope to accomplish in the immediate moment, but the breadth of the impact in other areas and the depth of the impact over time. And this is, I think, called second stage thinking by the Stanford economist. What's his name? The black economist there.
Thomas Sowell?
Yeah, Thomas Sowell.
Mm-hmm.
And so stage two thinking or something like that. You got to think past your nose when you pass these things and not just mm-hmm. be moved by your gut and your heart and think that's all that's necessary. And so I'm not sure if this is going the direction you want it to go.
No, it's great. I think what it's illustrating is that I might have been asking the wrong question. So mm-hmm. in a certain sense, rather than trying to debate them sort of biblically on, well, what does the Bible say about sort of the organization of economics, it's more just get back to that fundamental moral question of to whom is the instruction intended to help the poor?
Mm-hmm.
Is it to
yeah.
individuals in the church or the government? Rather than sort of get mired in, can we find, proverbs or something like this that give us little nuggets that we can
yeah,
hold on
or
to?
Something like or maybe expanding more on the notion of liberty. And some of the founding fathers might have been be helpful here because they developed mm-hmm. this notion well. And I mean, look at if you and I are walking down the street and there's a poor person panhandling. And I say, gee, I have such compassion for this poor person. I am going to dig into your pocket against your will, and I'm going to give this poor person money. and that's called love. That's called compassion.
Right.
That's called theft. Mm-hmm. If I dug into my own pocket, that's compassion. Now, it may be even ill-placed in that circumstance because
sure,
I might not be helping him at all. But certainly, why would we call that an act of love when we force somebody else to give? Another difficulty with institutions like that giving, and I mean institutions like huge bureaucracies that are responsible for redistributing the wealth, is the person who is the beneficiary has no person to say thank you to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There is no accountability. And when somebody gets money consistently from a blind, from a non-face, it becomes to them an entitlement. And I mean that in the richest sense of the word, they feel entitled.
Right.
And such, if the entitlement is cut off, then somebody has taken their money.
Right.
And then everybody gets mad and, you know, then so there's retribution. So this cannot be the way God intended for help to be given to the poor, because in so many ways this hurts the soul. So I think you're right in the sense that we should be looking at, well, who is that command to? And then how is the best way maybe we as a culture can encourage people to fulfill that enterprise?
Right.
And if we are concerned as a culture to do it, well, we should be giving churches then, religious groups, more latitude to do it successfully rather than, and this is what it appears to me now, and you're closer to the Beltway, so you could probably have a better view on this, having religious organizations get further punished and hampered from doing that job.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, especially with the culture wars being leverage for that, you know.
Yes, yes, that's right. So I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did. I think that's actually really helpful. I appreciate it. You know, one of those things in thinking about, you know, how should Christians vote or you know, what sort of policies should they encourage and favor, I think one maybe could get into some danger looking for too specific of answers in that, and rather look towards you know, maybe the moral questions.
Right. To some degree it depends, though. And so let me just give you I'm going to give you a specific answer that has broad implications for this issue. What I think Christians ought to ask the question: what is God's purpose for government? What is God's purpose for government? And we have two statements in the New Testament that I think that makes the central purpose clear: the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. In a word, justice.
Right.
Not social justice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
As one person said, and the same person I think that I referenced before, his name's Dennis Prager. Whenever you, I think he is the author of this comment, whenever you add any adjective to the word justice, you corrupt it.
Absolutely.
What's just wrong with justice, you know, plain old, whether it's social justice or racial justice or environmental justice or, God forbid, I saw this earlier today, earth justice.
Right.
Oh, God, help us, save us from that kind of stuff. Then, and again, I'm not against environmentalism, properly understood, but the earth doesn't deserve justice. Look at if the earth justice people wanted to really have a lot to work with, they should go to the moon, because there is a heavenly body that has been really beat up.
That's right. Absolutely.
I promise you, the planet doesn't care about justice. You know? And most of the universe looks more like the moon than the earth.
Right.
Right. So that ought to give us a hint about what nature cares about, if it cares about anything.
Right. It has no consciousness.
Yeah, but the government is the it should do justice, and that should be, if it does anything, it should do that. Now maybe it should do a little bit more, but only as a secondary issue.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing I think Christians ought to be asking themselves, and then there is a profound, I think, emphasis on liberty in the Bible, and this is something that was developed by the founders, and so those are, I think, principles that that are solid ones that can guide us in some of these things. But anyway.
No, that's extremely helpful. I really appreciate it,
Greg. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Greg.
Okay, right. Call again, please.
Thanks.
All right, bye bye. Got to go to our little 2-minute break, and I'll be back with more of your calls on Stand to Reason.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges waiting for our students are immense. Are the students you know prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are not prepared for the secular campus culture. It's time to step up the training our Christian students need to stand firm in their faith, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for one of our Rethink Student Apologetics conferences. In October, we're hosting two student conferences, one in Birmingham, Alabama, and the other in Orange County, California. These two-day conferences are designed to equip your students with the reasons for the hope they have in Jesus and the practical tools they'll need to answer the challenges they will certainly get. Plan to bring your child and encourage your church to send the youth group. Register today and find out more at rethinkapologetics.com.
All right, back with you here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, I am digging in my pile of papers here to pull out the material I had, was it last week, on the New Mexico Supreme Court decision regarding photographers not refusing gay weddings. And I saved it. A lot of times if I do these things, I toss it, but I saved it because I had a feeling we might be revisiting it, and we are with our next caller. So let's talk with Chris in Virginia Beach. Also Virginia. Okay, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
Hey, okay. You're an energetic one today.
Thanks. Sorry, I'm excited to talk to you.
Okay,
hey,
good. Thanks.
I called in a couple of weeks ago, also with a question about same-sex marriage, and I really appreciated your answer.
Oh, good.
The follow-up that I had to that is very... very apropos to the whole New Mexico Supreme Court decision here. The thing that I'm wondering about is, do you have any recommendations for how to address the broader issue of civil rights, homosexuality and civil rights, without maybe, if it's possible to do that without getting into biblical discussions? And if not, you know, what do you think is the best way for Christians to articulate biblical truth in the context of government? I tell you, the conversation that you were just having about social justice was outstanding. I really enjoyed
that
a lot as well.
Thanks.
At the end of the day, if you don't mind, I'll throw the little bit of disagreement that I had with you about your analysis from last week.
Sure.
And that being that the lawsuit that was brought in New Mexico was not brought necessarily purely in the context of same-sex marriage law, because both same-sex marriage and civil unions are still... I don't know if they're illegal, but they're not legal. You know, they have not been legalized in New Mexico. So that lawsuit was brought under that New Mexico, basically...
Civil Rights Act.
Civil Rights.
Yeah, that's right. That was part of the article.
Basically, homosexuals are a protected class under civil rights legislation, and I'm struggling to figure out how to discuss that without getting into the issue of... biblical morality.
If that's
a tough thing to do in the public square.
Right.
You know,
no, that's
when you get right down to it, you're talking about people saying, "Hey, I don't want to participate in this because it goes against my religious beliefs." Well, that's another one of those things that was brought up back in the civil rights era. You know, in the '60s. Well, I don't want to serve blacks at my lunch counter because I have some kind of religious aversion to that. Well, I don't think that we should advocate that people should be allowed to do that. So,
right. Well, so which means all that means is that any old excuse won't do when it comes to religious beliefs. All right. You're right. This was the New Mexico Human Rights Act, NMHRA. I didn't know that they don't have same-sex marriage or partnerships or whatever. Keep in mind, by the way, if there's no provision in the law for them, that doesn't mean that they're illegal. It just means that there's no provision. It doesn't mean that they're banned. Now,
right.
You're not
right.
saying this, but lots of people will use that language. It's the ban on same-sex. It's not banned. Anybody can walk down the aisle and pledge their troth and blah, blah, blah. It's just
right.
the government is not going to step up and say that this is exactly the same as a heterosexual union. That's the big difference there. Now, with
right.
regards to your concern, I understand that maybe those circumstances aren't there. The point I'm making is even this so-called human rights legislation, all on its own is enough to interfere with the religious liberties of the Huguenins who were the subjects of this particular court action. So once you get same-sex marriage in, you have additional kinds of legal precedent, legal action, legal crowbars, really legal clubs to beat up on people of conscience on this. So, it's not so relevant to the broader point because the same kind of argument can be brought up under any circumstance. And the thing that's left here is your question. Well, where do you draw the line with making the religious exemption claim? Is that
right? That's basically what I'm getting to, and in a way, it's tangentially related to the thing that you just talked about. In that, you know, what does the Bible say about the government's role? It's to constrain evil and to reward good. I'm paraphrasing what I thought you said.
Yes,
but
that's right.
Basically,
well, that's
right. So
Peter.
So when I get into these conversations with people about this very issue, you know, so then the question becomes who is defining evil? Who is defining good? How are we defining constrain? And so, you know, is it falling in the government's role to constrain evil if we were to say pass legislation we're way past, you know, banning homosexual behavior. That stuff's all been thrown out. But, you know, are we at least not sanctioning? Are we at least not rewarding, you know, what we consider immoral behavior if we allow someone to, say, refuse to provide services to someone at a homosexual wedding?
Yeah,
I mean,
how do you argue that? Yeah, well, the first thing is that this directive regarding my comments with regards to Peter or Paul's, they both said it in different ways, understanding of the role of government, was for Christians. So if the question is, how should Christians approach this, they need to answer the question, what is the purpose of government? And then in their political action, try to emphasize the biblical role of government, not some non-biblical role. That was the context in which that came up. If I were addressing a non-Christian with this, then I might make a different point. They might play the relativism card, like who's evil or who's good. But of course, that you can't avoid answering that question because the government does pass laws against evil and laws to promote good. So somebody's making those decisions. That has to be done. But with regards to this broader question, I think it is the best way to argue it is argue it based on the sanctity of the First Amendment, which speaks very explicitly about the protection of our religious liberty, and it speaks from two different directions. The way it's worded, you know, we are not limited in our freedom of religion, and the government can't step in from their direction and cause a limitation by an establishment of religion. So both aspects of that part of the First Amendment were meant to protect our freedom. Now, arguably, and I even pause when I say this because why should I say arguably? It seemed like anybody can see that at least that some people might have an argument that is religious regarding the promotion of a homosexual celebration. And so, because the Bible speaks about this, and this has been the centerpiece of religious American experience, the Bible speaks against it or seems to, and maybe there's a public discussion about whether it does or doesn't. But if some people think it does, then you've got a bona fide issue of religious concern there. When it comes to blacks eating at a counter, I never heard anybody say it's against my religion to let a black person sit on the bus or eat in the diner or something like that. I never heard that argument at all. And if somebody were to offer the argument, what I would say is a man's skin color obviously has nothing to do with any value the human being has. If you don't want to sit next to him, go somewhere else. But in the case of homosexuality, it's entirely different than skin color, especially as relates to marriage, where skin color has no bearing on marriage, and gender has a total bearing on marriage. So it's apples and oranges. And just because a person might say, well, why can't I say I have a religious problem with black people, doesn't mean that I have to surrender my claim to religious liberty when I say I don't want to take photographs promoting a same-sex union of any kind, official or unofficial. That strikes me as such an obvious, it is so obviously defended or protected by the First Amendment. And the irony here is, as I read the New Mexico Supreme Court ruling, this justice clearly says that the rights of the homosexuals to be photographed, well, that they have a right to be photographed by somebody who doesn't want to photograph them, and the guy photographing doesn't have a religious exception. That just is stunning to me.
Yeah, that was pretty mind blowing to me too. When you were talking about that, the First Amendment defense was the thing that I was very surprised didn't fly, and I certainly was bothered by that as well.
Yeah,
I guess the other thing I was wondering about. You just mentioned, so if you don't, can I?
Sure.
I'll just jump in on it. The issue of homosexuality not being the same thing as skin color in any given question.
I don't see how it possibly compares to that in any way, in anything that we would raise.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
No, I'm agreeing. I guess I'm agreeing with you that I cannot imagine any circumstance on which homosexuality and skin color are remotely parallel.
I agree with you, but I also know that that's the argument that I've heard. Anytime I get into a discussion about civil rights, you know, the use of civil rights law, civil rights arguments, this whole civil rights movement to promote homosexual behavior and homosexual rights is totally rooted in the basic concept, the basic belief that homosexuality is natural. It's the practitioners have no more control over it than a person has control over the color of his skin.
Yes, that's a belief of some people.
So it's exactly the same. So if it's wrong to discriminate against someone based on the color of their skin, then it's wrong to discriminate based on their sexual orientation.
To some degree, gotcha. I'm going quickly because of the time here, but to some degree, matters of fact are relevant to this. And it is a matter of fact that race is genetic and there is no moral significance to one's skin color. It is not a matter of fact that homosexuality is a matter of birth, period. Nobody can bring forth proof that that's the case. Indeed, we've been finding quite the contrary, and especially with the twin studies that have been done, it shows just the opposite. It's not genetic. So that's one thing. Secondly, is sexual behavior falls broadly under the rubric of moral conduct. We all acknowledge that, though skin color does not. So that's why there can be an arguable religious point that can be made regarding homosexual behavior, and none can be made with regards to skin color. And if somebody wants to keep tooting that horn, just because you say it so doesn't make it so. It's just lame to continue doing that. In fact, it does a disservice to the civil rights movement to suggest that. Here it says that the justice said we have to leave space for other Americans who believe something different. Homosexuals have all kinds of space to believe something different. Can you imagine there if there's a homosexual photographer who was approached by someone who was making a film against homosexuality? Would he have recourse to deny it just because he didn't support the topic matter? Would an animal rights activist be forced to film a hunting show when they thought this was deeply immoral? Frankly, even if they didn't invoke any religious rationale for their objection, I can't see why anybody would want to force them to do that. Even if there was no religious concern, why would somebody want to force someone else to film this when there are plenty of other people to film it? And I think this just shows the radical totalitarian nature of impulse of these people who are advancing these notions.
Yep. No, that makes a lot of sense, Greg. I appreciate it. Yeah, no disagreement there. I just really was interested to hear your thoughts on how to engage in the discussion in a winsome way, as you so well put it.
Well, thank you so much. And I've got a little bit of exercise talking with you, you know, and I got to be careful I don't blow my top on these things. But sometimes to me, and I'm just going to thank you for your call, Chris, and say goodbye to you. But listen, friends, in the last moments of this hour, sometimes it just seems that there are principles that are on the table. There are rationales here that are so easy to see, so clear. It seems so obvious to me that a religious case one could countenance the possibility of a religious case against same-sex marriage. I don't see why anybody would think that this is bizarre. That it's possible, it's arguable. You don't have to agree with the point to say that, well, it's possible to have a point like that, especially when the Bible seems to speak against this. But I don't see any and so therefore it could be construed very easily and understandably as a religious concern. I don't see any possibility of construing this the other direction. Where is the constitutional right for people to have those who don't want to photograph for religious reasons a same-sex union? Where is the right to have them photographed by people who don't want to do it or anything akin to that? Keep in mind, these photographers were happy to photograph gay people. They don't want to photograph a same-sex union. Oh, my goodness. All right, there you have it. Hour number three ahead of us, and I hope you stay with us. I'm looking forward to chatting with you on Stand to Reason. All right, final hour for y'all. Stand to reason. Let's see what I have for you this hour. Some callers online I'll get to you in just a moment. And actually room for more at 855-243-9975 if you're listening live anywhere through our app. Is one way you can do that, also right through your computer. So we do have a webcast, and actually you can see my face on Ustream. That's live now too, right? So I don't know anything about that, but Melinda's got it set up and Tom's working with it, so I can see my face too. If you want to, you can. I don't see the big advantage to that. But there are different ways to get this show. And if you're listening live, you can call in 855-243-9975. If you're not listening live, then you can call that number next week when I am live on Tuesdays from 4 to 7. Last week we had a brother call who is someone I know from working in his church and had some difficult times, lost his wife. In fact, we prayed for him today at our staff meeting. What a difficult thing. He called and asked for a counsel on trying to understand and to manage things. One of the things that he brought up was the difficulty he had with kind of getting his head knowledge into his heart. And I understand the concept, but that is, how can we take what I know to be, you know, influence my feelings? I think that's hard in a circumstance like our friend was facing and still is. I mean, this just happened a month ago, and it will be a long time of hardship and difficulty, as many of you know, when you face a serious loss like this, it just takes time. But I wanted him to know, and I pass this on actually two things. I wanted him to quit using the word head to describe knowledge, to modify knowledge, because it isn't just head knowledge. It kind of like it's information in the abstract. It was real, true knowledge, and real, true knowledge can have real, true impact on us when we treat it as such. And the other thing I wanted him to see is that though he had visibility of some people who'd gone through some hard times and seemed to be riding it out pretty well, that kind of made him feel bad because you know, he wasn't doing so well with it right now. And of course, people who are going through hard times and are not doing well with it aren't the kind that get up on stage and give testimonies right then. But the fact of the matter is there are massive numbers of people in that category. And even those that are doing well now had a long season of struggle with the Lord. Not that they were struggling with God, but the struggle, they were undergoing their struggle with God by their side. And even so, it was still a struggle. And we talked about some passages there. And my favorite verse right now, which is 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse, I think, 16 through 18. And that is Paul's reflection there of putting things in perspective. This momentary light affliction that we experience is producing. It's the affliction that is producing the eternal weight of glory. And so and that's knowledge. That's something we can hold on to. That is a truth. And if we focus on the truth to renew our minds, it's going to make a difference. Now, I mentioned that our caller wasn't the only person that has been struggling. I have another friend. In fact, I have a number of friends right now that have been profoundly struggling and going through just unbelievable challenges in their life, on the order, in some cases, as my friend who called last week and talked about losing his wife. Some are sick. Some have lost children. Some have lost livelihoods. Some are having struggles in their relationships and their marriage. But this other particular friend here that I want to speak about now, a close friend, it seems like he has been getting hit from every single direction, and he's been getting hit hard for years. He has almost died, and I mean really close, at least two times, maybe three times in the last couple of years, in his business because of his sickness, has lost all of his clients but one, right at a time when he's just purchased a house and put a big down payment on it, and he's a newlywed, fairly newlywed. And it just seems like every time I turn around, something hard is hitting my friend, and he's looking always for the next shoe to drop, and sometimes it does. Now, with that in mind, I just want to read you an email that he sent me a couple of days ago that, and we're praying for him as a friend. I just want to read this to give you his perspective on this. And he says here, the doctors have ordered a CT scan and some thyroid tests in the coming weeks. Please, as he continues in this saga about his health, please thank everyone for their prayers. And incidentally, all these tests cost money, which he doesn't have much of anymore because all of his savings are gone and his client base is virtually non-existent. So it's hard to pull himself back up. In any event, please thank everyone for their prayers and their expressions of concern and solidarity with he and his wife. It's encouraging to know you are all on our side. And then he says, I want you to know that everything I've learned from STR about theology and apologetics has greatly helped me in a real and personal way. It's because I know, and here he's got the word know in all caps, I know God is real and what his character is like, that it's because of that I can have confidence in his sovereign plans. I am glad I do not have to rely on feelings nor empty cliches about just have more blind faith during times as these. It's hard to force myself to muster up good feelings when there are all these intravenous tubes sticking in my arm. But instead, I've internalized justifications for my true beliefs about God. Let me read that again. I have internalized, this is called renewing your mind, friends. I have internalized the justifications for my true beliefs about God. And after I reflect confidently on these arguments, then, all caps, then the good feelings come as a consequence. So what he's saying here is he knows things. And I think I have said this before in a talk, that everybody goes through doubts, even yours truly. Every one of us wakes up in the middle of the night and wonders, am I on the right path? Am I making a mistake? Is God really there? Am I investing foolishly in the claims of Christ? And how do I get back to sleep? I'll tell you how I get back to sleep. I reflect on my knowledge. I think about those things that I know. I reflect on my rational mind. All of the reasons why I can trust that God is, and that he is good, and that he is here, and that his Son has made a way for me. It's the knowledge that makes a difference. Now, it doesn't mean that just this knowledge and reflection on it chases every single bad feeling away, that there never more again is any heartache, hardship, difficulty, uncertainty about God. There are often, as one of my teachers once put it, pockets of agnosticism, little parts of us that maybe are a little bit unsure. But as my friend here says, because he's internalized his justifications for his true beliefs about God, after he confidently reflects on them, then the good feelings come as a consequence. He continues, so don't ever let any of your critics tell you that what you do is just ivory tower head knowledge. In my case, at least, the knowledge I've accumulated about God with your help is what prepared my heart for all of this. It's because of your accurate teachings that I don't ask, why me? And then he puts parenthetically, after all, why not me? I'm not special. I wonder how many people have asked that. Why not me? What's special about me? There's a whole lot of other people that are experiencing this. In fact, that's precisely what Peter says in the end of 1 Peter, which is a fabulous book to read and to spend time in reflecting on, to feed your soul with, when you are struggling hard with these difficulties like that. And what 1 Peter, what Peter says here in the end is, he says, be sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour, but resist him firm in your faith, knowing, and here you go, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. It's verse 9 of chapter 5. The same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. So why not me? My friend asks. Nor, he says, do I have wild, unrealistic expectations that I would have health and wealth if I just name it and claim it. Consequently, I am not disillusioned with God in the least. Your ministry did not set me up to fail. You've always taught that there was no pixie dust, which is the title of a talk, which I make that point, you know, no magic. I tell my wife these things, it's just part, that these things that we're going through are just part of being in a fallen world, and the correct response toward God is gratitude. That he has protected us in the past, and that he hasn't allowed even greater calamity to befall us. But, he says, boy, it still hurts, and there hurts in all caps again. It still hurts all the same, doesn't it? Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And that's the reality of it. There's, I had a teacher early on that told me, kind of taking off on this no pixie dust theme, I had a teacher that told me, and here's a Simon and Garfunkel reference, but most of you probably are familiar with it. He told me that that Jesus is not a bridge over troubled water. He's not a bridge over it, but he will pull you through the troubled water if you can stand the tow. Yes, it still hurts. It does. For each of us that goes through a hardship or a difficulty, it still hurts. Oh, it'd be great if God would take that stuff away. But I've learned, friends, that it is the pain itself that God is using as a scalpel to do surgery in our lives. People change. Yes, they do, but they don't change easily. You and I don't change easily. Generally, we only change when it's too painful to stay the same. When it's more painful to stay the same than it is painful to change, then we take that path of least resistance. And what that means is that God oftentimes has to turn up the heat, make it more painful, and that is the surgery. That is the scalpel that is required for the surgery that he needs to do in our heart. Look, I take no pleasure and joy in telling you this because I'm in the same boat as many of you are in many occasions. I'm no stranger to this, and I'm not being maudlin. I'm not asking you to feel sorry for me. I'm saying I'm like you, that these same sufferings are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. And after you have suffered a little while, Peter continues, the God of all grace will himself establish you. I don't have the exact quote, but it's something like that. It's worth reading. That's 1 Peter 5. My friend closes his letter. Thank you for all you do, and please let the SDR staff know we are very appreciative of their prayers and their concern and their ministry impact on our lives. So it's a sweet letter, but it's I have had permission from him to read it anonymously, as it were, so it would be an encouragement to you. And I know that many of you out there need an encouragement. And it was encouraging to me to see my brother stand strong here. And we are glad to have a role in his life, building that knowledge, not head knowledge, but just plain old knowledge, the truth that will make a difference in many of your lives. We're glad to be part that play that part for God's glory. All right, let's jump to break early here, and then I'll get to AO in New Jersey and regular caller here and see what he has on his mind, and any of your calls, too, on Stand to Reason.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Paul encourages us to be ready with an answer when someone asks for the reason for the hope we have in Jesus. We can help you be ready with those answers. Stand to Reason's website has thousands of pages of free and helpful resources on current issues and questions. At str.org, you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the many issues that challenge Christian thinkers in today's world. Topics like why Jesus is the only way, are science and faith compatible, same-sex marriage, and many others. Take a few moments to explore str.org. You can sort through the content by topic, author, and resource type. All of STR's speakers have articles, podcasts, and videos that provide practical answers to challenging questions. Visit the blog daily, read the latest Solid Ground, interact with the weekly challenge, listen to the weekly webcast. I'm convinced you'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. Try it today. That's STR.org.
Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason. Don't forget the Rethink Apologetics Conference, a conference for middle school through college age students, is coming up in October. Two different locations, and we'll have our best talent, I think, at all of them. I don't know the total rundown. You can find that at str.org. October 11th and 12th, Birmingham, Alabama, and October 25th and 26th will reprise last year's Rethink Apologetics Conference in Orange County. Is that going to be at the same church that we had it last time? Yeah, that was a great venue. And we look forward to you and your young people, your college-age students being part of this so that you can get trained in the things that you need to stand firm for Christ in an increasingly hostile environment. So once again, Birmingham, Alabama, October 11th and 12th. Orange County, October 25th and 26th. All the info's at str.org. All right, time for AO from New Jersey. Hello, AO.
Hey, Greg.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Welcome to the show.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, so I was calling to kind of get some clarification / interact with you on a question you had last week.
Okay.
The background was a caller actually from New Jersey as well called about two lesbian couples potentially becoming Christians and what your advice would be.
And their and they had children.
They have children, that's correct.
Yes, uh-huh.
And what your advice would be. And then I thought you did an interesting job of bringing an analogous situation with the polygamous cultures.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed to me, if I understood you well, it seemed to me that your suggestion was with the lesbian couples, they shouldn't break up the family, but they shouldn't sleep together as Christians. But I'm not sure if this is what you said. This is a vibe I got, but I wanted to clarify.
Yes.
That with the polygamous family, you said they should also stay together as a family, so one man with two wives. But if I understood you well, you welcomed the idea of them still sleeping together. Am I correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I said that exactly,
yes,
but okay. Well, I'm not going to back away from it. I'm just trying to remember exactly, but okay. I can, sure. Okay, and then the problem, because I think that there are two distinct situations there, because under no circumstances is the lesbian sexual relationship right. But in the case of polygamy, you already have a commitment that's made to multiple women, which commitment entails a number of things, and sexuality is one of them. And there may even be children involved in the multiple wives. So I don't know what the alternative would be.
So you wouldn't see an alternative of, say, selecting one and being, quote-unquote, monogamous with one. Even if, like you said, because one of the things you mentioned, which I thought was good, was that, you know, a lot of those cultures, one of which I'm from, the women may not have a source of livelihood. So if the man takes care of the two women but only has marital or sexual relationships with one, you wouldn't see that as an alternative.
Uh-huh, right. Well, I'm open to that as an option. I'm not being dogmatic about that particular point. It is one of those messy situations, and you try to do the best that you can. And I guess one would argue that having multiple wives is not itself moral, or sleeping with more than one woman. And if you have multiple wives, you're sleeping with more than one woman, so you could have a celibate relationship with one and not with the other, and therefore kind of get the best of both worlds. And maybe that's a way that in those cultures Christians have worked it out.
So
I'm open to that as a possibility. I'm not dogmatic about this.
So kind of playing scenarios or whatever, there was a call also last week who mentioned about being, if I remember well, being divorced from his first wife.
Oh, yeah, that was a different call, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were of the idea, I don't know if I agree with this or not, but you were at least stating the point that the second lady, even though he's not officially married to her, he's living in the equivalent of a marital relationship.
Yes,
it's
it's a de facto marriage, and
witnessed
by the fact that they have been cohabiting for a long time, and they have two children that they are now raising together. So all of this, I don't know how you cannot call that a family, because families existed biblically before there were marriage licenses.
Okay, so throwing scenario in there, say these two ladies, you know, these two separate ladies.
You're back to the lesbians now, right?
No. I'm talking about this other caller who had two...
I see what you mean. Yes, okay, right.
So I'm kind of playing devil's advocate.
Okay, well, before you do, let me just bring the rest of the listeners up to speed.
Sure,
in this particular case, a gentleman called in. He had been married, then he was divorced, and then he was a Christian. He fell away and led a profligate lifestyle, and had a girlfriend that he then fathered two children with, and eventually returned to the Lord and then returned to that relationship. And so now he was with the girlfriend who he's had the two children with, and they are cohabiting but not in the same bedroom, and they are raising the children as a family for the sake of the children, even though they're not living together. And he's wondering whether he should go back to his first wife. And what I said was that he's essentially married already. You've remarried, and you shouldn't destroy the current marriage with children to go back to the first wife. That was the counsel I gave.
Okay.
So for the rest of the people listening, now they know what we're talking about.
Sure.
And
so kind of on that note, let's just play scenarios, more hypotheticals. Suppose the first wife, who was divorced, and the scripture also talks about, you know, trying to get back together. Suppose the first wife, assume everyone's Christian here, right?
Okay.
Both men and two women.
The first wife now
wants to get back with him, and she's a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also the second wife, or the second woman, whether wife or not, but according to your view, de facto wife.
Yes, I think
Your advice there was to... I think you said something like just formalize what's already there, you know.
Yes, that's right.
So what will be your counseling in that kind of situation where you have two women, you know, who he has some marital relationship status with? How would your advice be in that situation?
I'm not sure I understand the question. He would be in relationship as a husband to the second woman who bore his children, and he would formalize it so it could be, you know, let's make an honest woman out of her, you know, kind of thing. And and with regards to the first marriage, that was terminated a long time ago, and it's part of history. If he were single and not attached, then that might be a different circumstance, but that isn't his case.
So I get your point. Position then.
Yeah.
All right. I was just calling to clarify those things then.
You because what?
I was just calling to clarify your position on those things.
Oh, okay. Good. All right. So you don't necessarily have a disagreement with it or anything like that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm not sure I have so, you know, the first question that I asked about the polygamous situation.
Well, let me.
I understand your position. I'm not sure I would advocate that.
Okay, good. I'm curious then.
You're open to my position.
Yeah,
so I would advocate the second one of being celibate with one, but
I am
provide for both.
I am open to that, and again, it's one of those things where you got a difficult situation, and
sure,
maybe that would be the best thing. Let me ask you though, do you come from an African culture?
That's correct. I'm originally from Nigeria.
Oh, Nigeria. And you have polygamy because of Islam there, is that right?
You have polygamy because of Islam, and you have polygamy because of traditional religion
as
well.
Okay.
Actually, it's kind of bad because a lot of times Christianity has come in there, but, you know, the polygamy thing still goes on.
Well, I'm curious, how is it then that Christians in your country who are trying to live according to a proper conscience, how do they deal with that problem themselves? Do they have a solution to that?
I don't speak from any personal encounters. I don't know anybody who I knew of that sort. But I do know that there's a lot of people that did what you suggested. Now, I don't know what they did in the bedroom, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that there were Christians that had, you know, multiple wives,
mm-hmm,
and those kinds of situations there.
Mm-hmm.
I personally, I had my misgivings against it, you know, because I guess, you know, I'm very strong on, you know, one man, one woman.
Yeah,
kind of
right.
But I understand that it's a difficult situation, mm-hmm, when you come from a lot of them come from unsaved positions, and then the gospel comes around and they accept it. And so what do you do then? And, you know, especially now it might be a lot better because there's opportunities for women.
Yeah, well,
you know, back.
And let me just toss this. Well, that's good then. And, Ayo, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it.
No problem.
All right.
Take it easy, Greg.
Yeah, we'll talk to you next time. I'm a little curious about this. We'll just toss it out. And it doesn't have to be dealt with this week. But some of you listening to this who may have some insight on this, I'm not casting about just for your opinion and point of view necessarily, but if somebody has done Christian work or is a Christian involved in cultures that are polygamous, where you have Christian families that become Christian and there are multiple wives. I'm just curious how you've worked that out, or your community has worked that out, or the Christian leaders in your community or missionaries, whoever it happens to be, worked that out. I'm just curious what that's like. It ain't good, but I'm curious how they worked it out. You know, I was, I mentioned earlier that I was in Seattle yesterday, and I had a very interesting conversation. Actually, I left on Friday, I guess, and came back yesterday. And going up on Friday, I was sitting next to a young man, just graduated from college, and he was a very, very nice man, talkative, super friendly, intelligent, articulate, knowledgeable in lots of different things. And even though he's about 22 years old, I guess he just graduated undergrad in chemistry, even something that's less applicable to life, or I should say to getting a job nowadays. he's probably going on to graduate work. But so we were talking, and actually he saw me doing some stand to reason work and asked me what I did for a living. And I explained, as I usually do, I'm a writer, speaker, talk show host. I'm going to church, in this case, to train Christians to think more carefully about their convictions and have productive conversations with people. And he just said, oh yeah, okay. And just nodded his head, and kind of let it slide. Didn't take any bait there, and sometimes people do, sometimes they don't. So I don't always know then what's going on with them. It seemed like just a polite response, right? So then when I asked him what he did, he started talking about chemistry, and I was asking him about commercial applications and stuff. We just got in a conversation. I'm using my game plan. I'm drawing him out. He was an interesting guy anyway, so it was a lot of fun chatting. And when as we got to a certain point talking about the nature of making chemical applications, chemistry applications for whatever, pills and stuff like that, he began to describe to me about how in order to make these medications, you had to make what's called L-amino acids. Now, without getting real technical, amino acids are like clusters of molecules that have a very certain three-dimensional shape. And the best thing to think of is just think of your hand. Your hand is a three-dimensional shape, so it's very particular. But you have a left hand and a right hand. So these molecules can be in the same molecule, the same shape, but one could be a left-handed version and one could be a right-handed version. And he's explaining this to me as a layman. Now, I know about this because of the origin of life issue, which I'll bring up in just a moment. But when you have equal numbers of left and right-handed amino acids, you have what's called a racemic mixture. And this is the kind of mixture that happens naturally. And to get all of one, like all L, is really hard to do. It takes a lot of manipulation to get all left-handed amino acids if that's what you need to make your medicines. And when nature is left up to itself, what chance always produces is a racemic mixture. Well, so that's the background to it, but he's trying to describe the left and the right-handed, and I just threw out the word racemic, and he looked a little stunned that I knew what that meant. And he said, yeah, racemic. Oh, there you go. So you know all about it. And so he was able then to pick up his pace a little bit in his explanation. But now I had a question for him. And the question was, and this is a problem for origin of life people, because the Darwinian enterprise requires not only that life develop by blind chance without ends in view, with no telos, for no purpose, but it also start. It's got to get going. It's like having a football game, and you have to have the game. But in order to have the game, you have to have the kickoff. And the kickoff is the origin of life. And the origin of life requires amino acids that are all one kind, largely, all left-handed. And by the way, protein chains are like pearl necklaces, a simple way to put it. And every pearl is a different amino acid. But you have to picture the pearls all have to have, they have letters. They represent letters, and this long string of pearls with different letters on them are strings of amino acids that have to spell a sentence that's meaningful in terms of the biological activity of that amino acid. And it has a left and a right-handed form. So all of those pearls, if you will, back to my necklace illustration, not only have to have the right letter on them, but they all have to be left-handed in most cases. Well, how do you get all left-handed in the proteins? It's like by chance. It's like flipping heads 1,000 times without making a mistake. And 1,000 times is probably being generous, because amino acid chains could be longer and more complicated. You need a lot of those different kind of amino acid chains, proteins to make a living cell. So lots and lots and lots of coin flips all coming up heads in addition to the other problems of linking in a sequence that makes sense, makes a sentence that can be read by the cell, that all has to happen by chance. That's a serious problem for Origin of Life folk. And so I just, you know, I'm sitting there in the airplane, and I mentioned that to him. I said, I just have a question. Have you ever thought of this problem? It's hard to get left-handed amino acids. Yes, it is. And if it takes scientists, if it's so hard for scientists using their intellect to get these things all of one kind, to flip the heads by design all these times in a row, how does nature do it with no intelligent help on its own? And then I said, is that a fair question? Because he's thinking about it for a second. I said, is that a fair question? No, I'm asking is that a fair question? Because I want to get him to acknowledge that I'm on to a legitimate problem. And I know it's legitimate. I want him to acknowledge it. And he says that in fairness. He said, yeah, it is a legitimate problem. And he's chewing on that, and there's a long pause. Now, remember, he's already asked me about what I do for a living. And he's a smart kid. He can figure out where I'm going. And I asked him, why would you think something so improbable would take place? And then he says this. He said, well, I'm a scientist, and what we need is facts, empirical facts. And a book written 1,900 years ago is not scientific fact, and it has not been peer-reviewed. Very interesting response. Now, tell me, have I said anything about the Bible in this conversation so far? No. Was I referring to Christianity? No. I was asking a question about the empirical evidence and asking about its implications for thoughtful people. And that's exactly what I said to him. I said, well, I haven't mentioned the Bible at all. I wasn't talking about the Bible. And I was talking about the empirical evidence. So let me put the question to you again. Why would you think something so improbable would take place without intelligence when it's so hard for a scientist to do it with intelligence? And then he said, well, and what he offered me was basically, the universe has been around for a long time, the planet 3.5 billion years. So given enough time and enough reagents, you're going to get all those heads flipped in a row in all of those protein chains of amino acids without any problem. It's going to be inevitable. Now, I've heard this kind of statement before, but I had a question for him at this point, and the question was, have you done the math? Because, frankly, friends, I have seen the math. And you know, you can give 20 billion years to the universe, and you could have every molecule in the universe as a reagent in this thing, and you still aren't going to have the probability of getting the kind of things you need for a living cell, period. We've seen the math. The math is not in favor of this kind of thing. The math devastates this. And he said, well, I'm not a mathematician or a statistician, and this was kind of his brush off. And then we moved on to other things, and that was the long and short of it. I didn't push him further. Some of you might have thought I should have, but I just didn't want to make a big fuss about it because I think I said something meaningful. I offered him a stone in his shoe. He didn't seem to be that concerned about it. Maybe you'll think about it, maybe not. What I did want to make sure is, in addition to leaving a stone in his shoe, I wanted to leave a fragrant aroma behind. And so we ended up pursuing conversations about what turned out to be mutual interests, and we had a fine time for the next hour and a half on the plane. And I bid him farewell at the end, said all the best to you, Evan, and maybe you'll never see him again, but you never know, do you? You never know. All right, I'm Greg Kokel. Looking forward to your calls, 855-243-9975 here on Stand to Reason.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that'll help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that'll help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a 4-part template that'll help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the Gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the Gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the Gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to str.org to listen live or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time by going to str.org.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Show us Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, our final segment of the day, and just stumbled on a new book here the Enforcer has recommended to me. Is God Anti-Gay? It's actually a small book. I think it's from the Good Book Company, Questions Christians Ask. Maybe this is part of a series. But, yeah, here it is. Did the Devil Make Me Do It? Who on Earth is the Holy Spirit? What Happens When I Die? So there's a series of smallish books. This is hand size, you know, 80 pages. When I say hand size, you know, it's like a 5x7. But this one, the interesting thing here, I like the title because it's provocative. It's, you're not sure where the guy is who's writing it. But the subtitle, though, says, Another Questions About Homosexuality, the Bible, and Same-Sex Attraction. Now, this is written by Sam Alberry, LLRR. And Sam Alberry is a Brit, apparently. We're going to try to have him on the air. We'll see if that works out. I have not read this. The Enforcer has. What's interesting about this particular person is someone who self-described is someone who struggles with same-sex attraction. Now, he doesn't, is this true, Melinda? He does not identify himself as a homosexual, but rather as, so he is not finding his identity in homosexuality. He is identifying his sexual struggle. He is a person who struggles with same-sex attraction. He is not a homosexual. And I think that's a significant approach. If we ever have him on the air, we'll talk a little bit about it. But you may be interested in taking a look at this book. His chapters are, well, there's only five, Getting Started, The Bible, Marriage, and Sex, The Bible and Homosexuality, Homosexuality in the Christian, Homosexuality in the Church, and Homosexuality in the World, the general categories there. But he deals with a number of passages here. I have to see how he deals with the Romans 1 passage, because I've seen a couple of treatments, and I think actually the best treatment is my own on this one. But that's because I work with a very, I think, precise translation in the New American Standard, and it makes it very clear why homosexuality in God's eyes is wrong. Anyway, recommend that to you. Here's a piece I've had sitting in front of me for a while. Austrian man wins right to wear pasta strainer in license photo. This comes from NPR. In Austria, one of the strangest fights for religious freedom has come to an end. Nico Alm, a self-described pastafarian, fought for 3 years for the right to wear a pasta strainer on his head in his driver's license photo. His argument? Alm claimed he belonged to the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, and wearing the strainer was part of his religion. Now, you might have heard about, and this might sound familiar to you, because the concept of the Flying Spaghetti Monster is kind of a farce, kind of thrown at Christians who believe in God. And I can't remember who initiated this Flying Spaghetti Monster nonsense, but it comes up on occasion, and some of you will hear it on campus. We're talking with atheists. And the idea for them is that our claim that God exists is no better than the claim that a flying spaghetti monster exists. Now, what strikes me as odd about that is I don't think anybody actually believes in a flying spaghetti monster. Even this Austrian man who has won the right to wear his pasta strainer in his license photo. The vast majority of people on this planet believe in God. And they believe in God for reasons. And sometimes the reasons can be pretty good. So there just is no comparison. This doesn't mean that there is a God just because lots of people believe in it. I'm just saying that there's no comparison to the flying spaghetti monster. BBC reports, the article goes on, that Mr. Alm's pastafarian-style application for a driver's license was a response to the Austrian recognition of confessional headgear in official photographs. Apparently there's some other religious people who wear religious headgear. I guess that would be Muslims and possibly Jews. And the license took 3 years to come through, and according to Mr. Alm, he was asked to submit a medical interview. Submit to a medical interview to check on his mental fitness to drive. But straining credulity, the article says, tongue-in-cheek, I guess, his efforts have finally paid off. It is the police who issue driving license in Austria, and they have duly issued a laminated card showing Mr. Alm and his unorthodox item of religious headgear. The AFP reports that Alm now wants to apply for Pastafarianism to become an officially recognized faith in Austria. And there's a blog that you can go to if you want to find out the pictures here. Nice looking guy, but he looks a little stupid with the pasta strainer on his head. Obviously, this guy, I mean, I hope it's clear to you, he does not believe in any of this. It's just a stab at theists of some sort. So if he wants to look like an idiot, I guess he has the right to do that. I wanted to close with an issue that was raised by somebody who called in a few weeks ago and wasn't able to talk with me, but asked if I would address this, and that is the question regarding abortion. If abortion does in fact kill an innocent human being, should women who have abortions be face the death penalty? Actually, the way the question has been put to me is more by a challenger, and the friend had asked, because in light of the challenge, how I would respond. But the challenger says, since you believe the fertilized egg is fully human, should women who are raped and subsequently abort face the death penalty in those states that have it? Let me tell you something. That the fertilized egg is fully human is not a mere belief. It is a scientific fact. There is nothing lacking in the fertilized egg from its humanity if the fertilized egg is an egg of a human. It is fully human. Just like an acorn is fully an oak, and a cat feti is fully feline. All that needs to happen is the proper environment given for its development, and it develops more along the stages of what it already is. If it weren't fully human, it wouldn't develop humanly. I don't know how else to say this. This should be debate on this particular point because this is basic embryology, all right? And then should women who are raped, so then these bring an emotional factor in here, should they face the death penalty? Now, I guess the presumption is that if I'm going to be consistent with my view, I would have to mandate a death penalty for raped women who abort, and since that would make me obviously unkind, then abortion must be right. This is kind of a little bit of a twisted logic, but though it's twisted from a logic perspective, it has emotional force, so let me respond to it. I actually don't have an opinion on the degree of punishment that should be meted out in this case, because I think that's a separate legislative issue that I am not qualified to answer. Look, when in a fit of rage, a man fires a gun and kills another person, it's a homicide and it's criminal. But which punishment is appropriate under those circumstances is a much more complicated matter. Those are two issues. Determining whether it's homicide and determining how it should be punished are two separate issues. And this is why the law treats homicide by degrees. So you have first degree, you have second degree, etc. Now, generally speaking, I think my view is that the law should be consistent across the board. And so the consistency requires that if abortion actually kills an innocent human being, then abortion should be treated as a homicide. Now, if that sounds extreme to you, I just want to make an observation here of something that you may not be aware of. But fetal death is already listed under the homicide statutes of 32 states in the Union, including the great state of California. Fetal death is homicide, and it provides appropriate penalties for it. So two-thirds of the states in the Union have treat fetal death as homicide and punish it. Now, of course, in those states, there's an exception. And the exception is when the death is at the hands of a doctor and the mother says it's okay. In other words, legalized abortion. Now, I don't know how this is sitting with you, but doesn't it strike you as a little bit odd that if you kill a baby in the womb, you are charged with homicide unless mom says it's okay and a doctor does it? Isn't the baby still the baby? Isn't it still just as dead? Isn't a corpse a corpse? Why is it not homicide when mom says it's okay to do it? Does that work with three-year-olds or teenagers? That might be a better application. In any event, other states treat drug use by pregnant women as actionable. It's child endangerment. But abortion is the odd exception here. Now, it turns out that very few actual homicides rise to the level of capital crimes. I think it should be up to lawmakers, frankly, to decide what the appropriate punishment is in the case of abortion. I'm not skilled in those legal particulars. I don't know how to decide what punishment is right. But I will tell you one thing. I do have adequate skill to know when an innocent human being is killed without justification. And that's what this debate is all about. It should not be sidetracked with questions about how are we going to punish this. Let's just, first things first, we have precedent. We had these fetal homicide laws already in place. Why can't we use those? We also had abortion illegal before 1972 in most states. So why aren't the laws pertaining to that applicable here? It isn't like if you're pro-life, you're committed to taking poor raped women who had abortion and hanging them. Though this is the way the question wants to make you look. No, I have enough skill to know when an innocent human being is killed without justification. And it's really not about the admittedly more complicated matter of how to prosecute these cases. The questions are completely separate. You have to answer the first before you can begin to address the second. And as such, I think this challenge is really unrelated to the larger issue, and that our larger issue is, does abortion kill an innocent human being? That is the question that needs to be answered. And behind that is another question that I simply call only one question. And that question, that single question, is what is the unborn? Because if we determine that the unborn is a human being, a valuable human being, well, then it seems no justification for abortion is adequate. If it's not, no justification for abortion is necessary. So everything hinges on this question. And it's a question largely not asked by people in this debate. So I am not surprised that this kind of challenge is brought against pro-lifers. It's kind of a standard, rhetorically clever, emotionally charged way to try to make the pro-life view look extreme while sidestepping the real issue. And my view that abortion is homicide is not extreme. It's consistent with the way the law routinely regards fetal deaths by other means, and therefore ought to be treated in the same way. All right. Well, that's it, friends. Thanks so much for being part of the show and part of our conversation. And I hope that the things I've offered you here these last 3 hours will help you to be a more effective ambassador for Christ if you are one. And if you're not, I hope I put a stone in your shoe and annoyed you in a good way. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye.
Been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.